This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Inside Story on BFM 89.9.
Good evening. This is Inside Story with Lee Chui Lin and Shamila Ganesan. Tonight, are our social safety nets enough when a crisis hits?
So we're talking about this because of the most recent floods, of course. First, we look at how the floods have affected our most vulnerable communities. And then a point has been raised about low-cost housing being built in flood-prone areas. So we find out more. Finally, a look at the call to allow for EPF withdrawals and what other financial support is needed.
So on that note, tell us, do you think EPF withdrawals for flood aid is the way to go? What else could we look into? Call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. This is Inside Story. It is 6:07, and I think we should start perhaps with a brief update on the flooding, as well as how many people have been affected, because we can't really talk about the floods in the past tense. Essentially, they are still ongoing. While the massive, massive floods that hit a lot of Peninsula Malaysia last month was deemed a once in a 100-year flood, not a lot of people have been a fan of that phrasing or branding, by the way. It ended up displacing over 40,000 people. The most recent death toll is 48 lives lost. And in fact, Negeri Sembilan, Pahang, Johor, Melaka, Sabah are all continuing to experience flooding due to heavy rain. And as you might have heard, in fact, in our news bulletins, the expectation is that in a state like Pahang, for example, heavy rain is expected for quite some time more.
Yes, and although it was, it is something that continues to be a concern as we move forward, I think it's worth looking at how I think it's worth looking at it from the perspective of this 100 years and whatever aside. What do we have in place to protect those most in need when something like this happens? Because it's one thing to say, you know, people in the B40 groups may not have enough of a social safety net. But what happens when a crisis hits, and are we equipped? Is there enough put in place to be able to care for these members of our community? And a couple of different things that have come up in the last few weeks following the floods have actually highlighted even more how fragile this whole situation can be. So this is, on the one hand, we have the call by a number of lawmakers. So three federal lawmakers alleged that there could be possible abuse by DBKL when it comes to approval for housing development at 6 retention ponds. And we did cover that in detail last week. But I think the thing that is also getting a lot of attention is the fact that two of those developments are earmarked for low-cost housing development. And Hannah Yeo has pointed out that earmarking flood-prone areas for development, for housing for low-income earners feels like a particularly egregious choice.
Yes, I think we should look at her quote, her exact quote, because it sums it up. So she said, residents who can't afford to buy houses are to be given homes in flood-prone areas. We need to give them dignity. Stop giving them ponds to be made into homes. And then when it floods, we give them 1,000 ringgit in flood aid. That is not enough. And I wanted to bring up that quote because it opens up the conversation to the next part, which is the 1,000 ringgit in flood aid. I want to be clear here that it is not actually a special flood aid. This is something that has been said over and over again, that the 1,000 ringgit is actually part of general crisis aid. You know, it was earmarked anyway. It is not on top of anything that was already provided by the budget or already in place, right? Instead, it's something that was ready to be given and then the crisis struck, so it was given. It is not actually specific to this particular moment, this once in a 100-year flood. And so when we think about that 1,000 ringgit and what it can actually cover, I think for most of us, if you take a quick glance around your home, your office, if you think about the kinds of things that would be damaged by the floods, by waters that would need replacing, never mind your emotional or mental, you know, state of being, we're talking only about things. if you just take a look at your things and think about how quickly you would spend 1,000 ringgit, and then we add in medical costs, we add in things that you might need in order to feel better, in order to be healthy, then I think it becomes easier to understand why it is that this 1,000 ringgit has been widely seen as not enough, especially if we're talking about people who had already had their finances hit by the pandemic. And so it's kind of insult to injury at this point. And there has been a call for EPF withdrawals to become something of an option, at least for people. Now, I'm not necessarily proposing this. I think that it has also had people saying this is also not the way we have to think about the future. And for what it's worth, the finance minister has already said that it's actually not going to happen. But yeah, I think this opens up a larger question about what kinds of financial aid we're actually providing people.
Yes, because that call to allow people to withdraw EPF has its roots in the fact that there are no other means for people to turn to, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if we look at the allocation that the government has announced, up to 10,000 ringgit for each household affected by the floods, up to 61,000 for those who suffered total destruction. And that, of course, comes on the wake of the Bantuan Prihatin Rakyat, the COVID-19 Special Assistance Fund. The thing is, these are all one-off or... what's the word? Like from point to point, you fight the fire after it's happened, rather than put something in place. And when we look at what's in place, apparently the only choice we have are the EPF accounts. And that just feels like such a precarious place to be in.
Which is why we wanted to spend today looking at the idea, or not the idea, but the social safety nets. I don't want to call them ideas because they're real. They should be tangible things. It's something that we should have in place. And yet it would appear that in a time of crisis, they haven't been enough. So we'd like to hear from you on this front. Essentially, well, what are your thoughts in general when it comes to our crisis management or the kind of aid that's been available for flood victims? But also, do you think EPF withdrawals for flood aid is the way to go? And what else can we look into? That number to call is 7733 2900. WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. After this, we are going to be looking into how vulnerable communities have been impacted. And for that, we'll be speaking to Klang MP Charles Santiago, so keep it here, BFM 89.9.
Bombing frustrated minds, BFM 89.9.
It is 6:16 and you are listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila, and we are talking today about our social safety nets, particularly for a crisis. And this is in light of the recent floods, the recent ongoing floods, in fact. And we thought we could start off by looking at how our vulnerable communities, our most vulnerable communities in Malaysia, have been affected. We're going to be speaking about that shortly. But in the meantime, tell us, do you think that EPF withdrawals for flood aid, this is a recent point of contention, is the way to go? What else can we look into when it comes to financial assistance? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. And joining us now to talk about this is Klang MP Charles Santiago. Charles, thanks so much for being with us. So talk to us about Klang and how it's been affected by the flooding.
I think Klang was one of the most, is one of the places that was affected quite badly on 17th, 18th, and 19th of December. You have, Klang is actually a very huge place. Some of the places that were badly affected was Klang Utama, Batu Belah, Bukit Raja on one side. And then on the other side, you have Pulau Indah and Telagong. It was a scene from a hurricane movie, especially in Pulau Indah and Telagong. And you also had problems in Taman Melawis as well as Bayu Perdana. In fact, I think in one way or the other, Klang and the larger Klang, if I can use that expression, had water in their house. So it's no doubts about that. Except that if you were staying in high-rise buildings, so that's a different ballgame. But most of them were affected. Even rich folks in Bukit Tinggi and so on and so forth were affected. Water entered their houses. So in some sense, everybody was affected, but some of the critical areas which is still recovering would be like Pulau Indah. In fact, Telagong today had another problem as well. The bund broke this morning. And then now JPS is there together with our volunteers in order to close the bund, because the high tide, the protection for high tide is still in place till Wednesday. So hope that the water doesn't enter into the homes and also into the factories in Telagong.
Who are some of the segments of the community that have been hit the hardest? Could you tell us about what they're facing?
I think in terms of category of people, the worst hit actually are the orang aslis in Pulau Indah. I mean, if you go to their house, just like other houses, but these houses, the hall will be totally empty. At least before, you'll have a broken chair, or you'll have a chair, you'll have, you know, a small bed, you'll have clothes in there. But now you have nothing there whatsoever. I was there this past Saturday, and it was totally empty. I've been there since two, three times since the last 1 week, 2 weeks, trying to bring in support together with NGOs who are also providing cooking facilities, food aid, groceries, and a whole lot of support so that they can restart their families. So, but the most important at this time would be to get beds, cooking equipment, cupboards, you know, those kinds of stuff, the basic stuff that they would have lost. I would say that each house, at the minimum, would have lost anywhere between 15,000 to 20,000. At the minimum, I say minimum, because in Pulau Indah, it'll be about, you know, 15,000 in the Orang Asli areas. Whereas in other homes, it'll be about 20,000, 25,000 easily, depending on the quality of furniture, cupboards, carpets, cooking stuff that they had lost, clothes. In some houses, some families do not have clothes. In fact, last week we were providing support, relief support in groceries, detergents, mops, and all kind of stuff in Tulogong. And there were some children who walked in to the center with their parents without slippers. So I asked the father, "Hey, how come your child doesn't have a slipper?" He said, "All got wiped out. Semua kena lenyap." And that is an expression that I heard, I think, about 5-6 times being there for the last about 2 hours. Parents saying that they've lost everything. We were providing a lot of detergents, all kinds of stuff. And people were taking it, in a very generous fashion. And I was just joking and asking them, "Hey, are you taking this for 1 day, 1 week, or for 1 year? What is it using it for?" And then this Mache looked at me and said, "Wabi, saya telah hilang semua." And then when I went to the house, it was I couldn't sleep after that because there's nothing there. The children have no clothes. The children have no clothes. Forget about slippers. They have no clothes to wear. The books have all been wiped out, taken off. So it's really a movie where you have you're watching a movie in front of you, you know, unfolding, and where the actors are people that you know, and the place that you're comfortable, that you're familiar with. So it was very sad, very, very sad that the most vulnerable people had it worst, and that is why, you know, in your introduction you talked about a social protection mechanism in times of an emergency. I think this has to be activated. This has to be thought through more carefully. Otherwise, if this unfolds again this year, which is highly possible, again, we will not have learned a lesson.
So, you know, you've painted a picture really of what things are like and also what the short-term needs are. But, you know, if we look at vulnerable communities and households, you know, we're talking 15 to 20K worth of losses in some instances. What are some of the main challenges in making a full financial recovery?
Well, I think every home will have its own challenges. Every home will know exactly what they lost. There's some things that they will not speak about, like jewelry in the house, documents that, you know, involving money and so on and so forth. So this is a bit challenging. Some of them have insurance for floods, and most do not have. I think 95% do not have, especially the poor. Their motorbikes, their cars will not be insured. So now they have to either acquire a new a vehicle or repair the one that they will have. But, you know, this motorbikes and cars have been soaked in water for 3-4 days ago. So I'm not so sure if we can use them. And then some houses will require new lightings, complete wires, wiring of the houses and so on and so forth. And this is going to be costly as well. So these are some things that we have not factored in. And this is where the government has to move in to ask each of the homes what exactly they have lost out. What we can say from the outside, loss of furniture, beds, cooking stuff, carpets, cupboards, clothes, books, you know, something physical we can see. But some people have lost their jewelry, and the wiring has to be redone again, which we have not factored. This is something that has to be factored. And other stuff that we don't factor in the first instance. So this is when the government has to go in and do a different kind of an audit on houses and then provide support as required. So I've been floating the idea that the government has to give a minimum of 8 to 10,000 at a minimum, and then higher depending on the severity of the problem. But this is the 10,000 is to quickly get through the first phase of the recovery. So the first phase of recovery will require, you know, cooking. You need to cook. So you need to buy your stove. You need to get your kettle. You need to get your cooking, your rice cooker. So these are the basic stuff that has to come into the house. You need to get a washing machine after that because parents are working, so they don't have the time to wash clothes. So these are the basic first phase of the recovery stage. So if you say you can look at it at many different stages. The first stage is get the basic thing back to the home. And I think Lynn and Shamila, these homes have lost everything. I think people must get it into their heads. They have lost everything. You're walking into an empty home. You're essentially rebuilding the home. And the speed in which you build will depend on the resources that you have. And poor people like here, from the Orang Asli to workers in factory workers in Pulau Indah and Telukong, really don't have much to start. Given that, you know, they had 1 year of COVID, 1 year of wage reduction, one year of job losses. So we are starting at a very low base in terms of rebuilding the Malaysian family going forward. So lots of our families are really under the gun, really under the pressure, under the gun. And this on Sunday, we distributed about 6 or 7 different kinds, including fish, vegetables and fish to about 1,000 people in Klang Mutama. And I'm hearing their stories. I hear what they got to say, and how high the water went into their house, how they have lost their assets, how they have lost their money, how they have lost their jewelry, how they have, they can't switch on and switch off the lights because the wiring system has completely collapsed. So you can see the problems that they have. But also there's an expectation. And this expectation is why a social protection mechanism is essential in order for us to support. And one of your newsreaders were reading that money should come out from EPF. I don't think it's a good idea. That's my view. The government must step in. Big corporations must step in now in order to support society. Big corporations that in Klang have to come up. They're not talking to some of them who are providing support. And I think most of big companies, GLCs, should now come out, step up, and provide the support. This is for Malaysia. And in providing support in rebuilding our homes, you also rebuild the economy. You create a new demand in the furniture industry. You create new demand in new kinds of industry, which otherwise would not be happening. And these are not talking about thousands. You're talking about, Klang has got 1.5 million. Klang is as big as Penang, or maybe even bigger than Penang. So that's the population you're looking at. So this will give a major jumpstart to a local businessmen who are involved in the furniture industry and who are involved in other related industries involving flood and relief efforts and so on and so forth.
Charles, unfortunately, we're out of time with you, but thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, we're just starting.
unfortunately not, but thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Lynn. Thanks, Shamila. Thanks, bye-bye.
That was Klang MP Charles Santiago painting a picture, really, of how the floods have affected Klang, but also, more generally, what it is that has happened, how it's affected our most vulnerable communities, what more needs to be done, because that is the focus of our show today. Are our social safety nets enough when a crisis hits? That's the question we want to hear about. You can let us know what you think. But also, do you think EPF withdrawals for flood aid is the way to go? That number to call is 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be back for your messages shortly. Keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Break from mediocrity. BFM 89.9.
It is 6:37 and you're listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila. And we're talking today about social safety nets and whether we have enough of them, whether they're doing a good enough job, especially in a time of crisis. And we're talking about this because of the recent floods, the ongoing floods, and the fact that we are seeing 1,000 ringgit come out for financial aid. We're seeing people talking about needing EPF withdrawals, that not happening. And so with that, we just wanted to hear from you, essentially, well, are our social safety nets enough when a crisis hits? And do you support the withdrawal of EPF for flood aid? Do you think that's the way to go? You can call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, before we move on to our next segment, a quick look at the messages that we're getting.
So, plenty of opinions. Arvindran says, withdrawing EPF is not a feasible solution in the long run. The fund is meant for the future. But if the government can replace the withdrawn funds, then it can be a fast and immediate solution. That's an interesting one. Replacing withdrawn funds. I mean, if we're talking about crisis-driven solutions, I suppose that's one way to go.
If that's the case, then we could also just create separate funds, right, for the government to disburse rather than needing to wait for the replacements and the withdrawals and so on. And then I think it would also be less reliant on, say, how long you've been working, you know, just things like that, how much you actually have in your EPF. We also have Belinda who says, Charles said it right. It's time for big corporates and GLCs to come in to help. It's no good when you practice CSR when things are normal. It's during crisis, such as the recent floods, that you need to help in whatever way you can.
I completely agree. I think that that's exactly what social responsibility means, right? It doesn't have to be driven by photo opportunities and being able to publicize what you do.
So here's the other side of that, right? I think that the other thing that we need to consider is the fact that we're talking about social safety nets and that therefore that means we're taking a long view where we're not talking necessarily about short-term aid, even though that is hugely important. But I think the argument here is a little bit that short-term aid would be easier to access if we had made long-term plans a little while ago. And so I think when we consider CSR and what it is that GLCs or big corporates are able to do, there is also the unsexy work of building these systems as opposed to, like you said, right, bags of rice and stuff. I mean, that's great, but does it actually help to build a more sustainable system to provide help to people? So keep those thoughts coming. What do you think? Are our social safety nets enough when a crisis hits? And should EPF withdrawals for flood aid be the way to go? You can call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, we mentioned earlier that there has been this other issue of some of the flood retention ponds. So that's its own thing, right? Having been approved for development. And now actually, two of those ponds were earmarked as for, among other things, a low-cost housing project. And I think that has opened up questions about what are we doing, really? And what does it mean when we provide this sort of housing on unsafe land, potentially? So to find out more on that, we're crossing over to Ihsan Zainal Mokhtar, President of the Malaysian Institute of Planners. Ihsan, thank you so much for speaking with us. Now, could you walk us through the process of how housing developments are approved to begin with?
Okay. All developments require for the developer. You call a person a developer, whoever develops a piece of land. And in the case of housing, it could be from the government, be also private sector. And it has to go through what is called a planning process. So what happens is the developer will definitely consider the type of housing that they would like to provide, the mix, and they will do their cost analysis and submit that to the local authorities. Now, they would have to submit with the plans a report, a development proposal report, which does take into consideration all the requirements that you mentioned earlier, other technical and engineering requirements. So the environment will be taken into consideration, requirements of the authorities, the engineering requirements, and all the requirements that has actually been clearly stated should be clearly stated in the report.
And are there specific factors that are taken into consideration when it comes to affordable housing developments?
Okay. The developers in or the requirements by each state authorities, wherever you submit, might vary differently, like to the number of housing units according to the state policy that must be affordable housing. But the in terms of its location, there's no specific direction that the location must be in the most or at the most prime location within the area. But that doesn't mean that it's always put in a location that least desirable. And also, as you said, or as you told me, that in some cases it's put in areas that are prone to flooding.
Yep.
So it, if it's found in flood-prone areas, it's more, let's put it this way, Kuala Lumpur itself is flood-prone. It's a confluence of two rivers. Yeah, so you definitely would try to flood-prone areas for any development. But and most developments are not supposed to be in flood-prone areas. But there are circumstances where you can't avoid it, but you would avoid that at all costs, unless that's the piece of land that you have and happens to be in a flood-prone area. So if you want to do the development and you submit to the authorities and you show how that flood mitigation can be considered, and it should not be an issue. You see, because floods are supposed to be in a certain pattern and location, so you do try to avoid it. But in the cases, you know, urban areas especially would have very limited amount of land available for development. But that doesn't mean that you should develop right beside the river or in a flood-prone area. But in certain circumstances where there is no available land, and then mitigation measures must be taken into consideration. So that's a very important point to be considered when the authorities consider the development. But in the first place, you should try to avoid flood-prone areas. That's the key there.
So with that being said then, what has led to affordable homes being approved for development in flood-prone areas?
Okay, the Sri Muda flood-prone area wasn't supposed to be there in the first place. It was supposed to be a canal city or something like that, where it's part of the drainage system. But it has been built, and you can't stop that building. And you also should also remember that there are many places that are under flood area, or you have to learn to live with the flood. Take Netherlands as a country, you know, they are below the sea level. There are many other examples of cities that actually have to exist below the sea level and in flood-prone areas. But you do have to take the necessary mitigation action. That does not mean that, you know, it's not an area that you would prioritize. But take the example of Sri Muda. You are in a flood-prone area. Therefore, there has been mitigating actions put into place. The floodgates is one, and the pump didn't work, as I think everybody would know by now. Actions to reduce flooding should also be in place, and even the design. For example, if you know Sri Muda or areas like Sri Muda, which are to be developed, then even the design of the houses can take into consideration of that. So that's just not developing in a flood-prone area is not the solution, but managing it, having the mitigating action. But we also should look towards the bigger picture, which is, like I said, we are in a climate crisis, and we should not take that as something that is lightly. And I think definitely the government can do more to ensure that we protect our environment, to ensure that flood mitigating methodologies and ways are taken into consideration. And, you know, there's many things about the environment which I think we have not done enough. And I think we do not respect the environment. And by just not having, you know, areas, housing or flood-prone areas is not the only solution.
So to hone in on that then, what are the dangers of developing homes on land that were originally marked for retention ponds?
Well, a retention pond is not supposed to be where we are supposed to develop in the first place, right? But definitely we will reduce. You see, we have to look at the environment in the bigger picture. Now, retention ponds and detention ponds are see, because the flood level, what we use to understand areas that are flood prone and where we plan for retention and detention areas, these areas have grown or they are now, we need bigger retention areas. We need bigger detention ponds. So if we reclaim these areas to develop, that's a no-no. You know, we should actually be looking at ways to ensure, for example, that the surface runoff, you know, we have so many roads and buildings, so the water runoff is much faster, and therefore, if there's a blockage to it, it will create a flash flood. We have to ensure that our surface area is more permeable. It accepts more water. We have to ensure that if the rainfall exceeds what is normally happening during the season, that you have areas that are designated for the water to flow into. So you can have mini retention ponds. You can have wetlands within even smaller developments. You can even have concepts where, you know, the recreation area is also part of the retention pond when the rainfall exceeds the normal flow. So this must be planned well and must be planned early. For example, if I talk about area coverage, if you have 100 acres of land for development, you must ensure there is enough land and surface area and retention pond to absorb the exceeding rainfall during any particular time. So that the area does not necessarily mean it cannot be used. It can be used for a football field. It can be used for it's a multi-use space. Of course, you should not build a house there. Okay? But if you have to, and then like I said, you have to take into consideration of where or how you control the water.
So in closing, how would you like to see developments of housing areas improved, especially considering flood risk?
The process is there. The process is already in place that you should take into consideration the existing condition. You should take into consideration, you should provide retention ponds. You should respect the rivers. You should respect the topography. You should not do cut and fill. You should consider where the underground water flows. So you have to follow this. You can't just reclaim marshlands or wetlands and not consider all this. And not only that, like I said, you will lose a lot of space. Okay? For example, now it's kind of like rule of thumb. You're supposed to provide 10% open space. So now maybe we should increase that standard, increase it to 30%. Increase it to ensure that, like I said, space are used also for recreation and also for retention. We should look at into our designs of houses, you know, and in some areas where it floods annually, where you know for sure it floods, maybe the house should be on stilts. I had one discussion. I was told that when this was proposed in a particular state, the public was not keen on it, that you would lose one floor to be designed on stilts, that you would increase the elevation of, raise the level of roads connecting vital areas. They say it's costly, you know. But look, you know, if we don't do this, this 2021 last year or still going on this year's disaster will happen again and again, and it will only get worse. So instead of providing good, safe housing for the affordable group, if you like, everyone will suffer, whether it's affordable housing, whether it's anybody else. You have to raise the bar in terms of taking care of the environment.
Ihsan, thank you so much for joining us today. That was Ihsan Zainal Mokhtar, President of the Malaysian Institute of Planners. After this, we look into that suggestion regarding the EPF. Keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Break from monotony. BFM 89.9.
It is 6:53 and you're listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila. And now we are going to look at the suggestion for EPF withdrawals to be a part of Flood Aid. This is part of our larger look at social safety networks. On the line with us now is Professor Dr. Jeffrey Williams, economist and Dean of the Institute of Postgraduate Studies at the Malaysia University of Science and Technology. Prof, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Pleasure. Happy New Year to everybody.
Happy New Year. So let's look at this idea of allowing for more EPF withdrawals to help flood victims. The finance minister has said it's not a good idea, even though thus far they've actually allowed up to 71,000 ringgit in various withdrawals. What's your take?
I think on this occasion, he's right. I don't normally come on BFM and say such a thing, but on this occasion, I think he's absolutely correct to say this. EPF is really not the best way to solve this problem for the flood victims. We understand that they've suffered terribly and they need to get help immediately. And making applications through EPF is not going to give them immediate help. Many of the people who need help most acutely and most urgently are actually the people who have already wiped out their EPF accounts. And so they would go to EPF and ask for further withdrawal only to be told that they have nothing left. So they need to have much more direct, immediate, straightforward forms of assistance.
So speaking of which, at the moment, the most immediate form of aid is that 1,000 ringgit compassionate aid, which is to buy electrical items. What do you make of this amount?
Well, I mean, clearly it's not enough. And I think the government have already acknowledged that it isn't enough. And they've already made an announcement that people will get much more than that if they're eligible, up to 10,000, or if their house has been damaged, up to 61,000. The only thing that we can say about the immediate response is that it has been quick, and we've seen some data today which says that most people have been able to receive it within 10 days. Now, that's a good thing, but of course, it's not the right amount. It needs to be much more than that. So if they can give people 1,000 ringgit or so within 10 days, they can also give them more money within the same similar period, and that's why it's much better for them to look at giving them more money and using the same process that they've already used for issuing this small amount to begin with.
Can the government afford to do more? I mean, what other avenues could be explored in terms of providing financial support for Malaysians?
Well, the government can afford it. That's the bottom line. It's actually not anywhere near such a large amount as you would imagine. Today, we had some data from the Prime Minister which told us that 61.2% of eligible people had already received the first initial handout, and that's about 46,000 households. So if you make a quick calculation, it would look about 75,000 households, 75,400 households would be eligible. And if you were to give them 10,000 ringgit each, that would be about 754 million ringgit, which is less than a billion ringgit. So it's actually perfectly affordable. Now, even if you were to allocate a budget of a billion ringgit, the government can easily find that in the current, within its current expenditure. It wouldn't have to have any further borrowing. It wouldn't have to look for any more printing of money. It already has it.
Now, in the long term, then, should that budget have larger allocations in anticipation of climate-related disasters? What could that look like?
Well, I think part of the problem in terms of people being hit under the current circumstances is that there wasn't sufficient investment in the past. But it's not just a matter of money. I think you're right to say that the government should spend more money on these sort of issues, but it's not just money. It's also about issues of planning where houses are built, planning for flood defences, issues about clearing the forests and this sort of thing, and enforcement of legislation. So money is important, but also this enforcement and planning issue has to be tightened up.
We have just under a minute left with you. How can we hold the government accountable when it comes to exactly what you were talking about, right? Proper aid disbursement, preventing leakages.
Well, there's an election coming up, and that's the best way to hold politicians to account. If they don't do a proper job, hold them to account in the election.
Prof, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Happy New Year again.
You too. That was Professor Dr. Jeffrey Williams, economist and Dean of the Institute of Postgraduate Studies at the Malaysia University of Science and Technology, weighing in on EPF withdrawals as a form of financial assistance for those affected by the floods. We'd like to hear from you. What's your take on that? But also, More broadly, are our social safety nets enough when we have a crisis? You can call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. We will be back for your messages after the 7 o'clock news. This is Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.